Hi, this is Coach John Cook, and I can't even begin to tell you how weird it feels to be doing the beginning of a podcast right now. If you are a regular listener to Talking Hoops with Coach John Cook back in 2020, when the podcast was really rolling, I appreciate all of the listeners that we had, and we've not done an episode since 2020. And this is what should have been the end of season one. 2020 was a remarkable time in everybody's lives with the pandemic, and it was an exciting time to start a podcast. And to be honest with you, for 76 episodes of the podcast, I had basically nothing but a blast. And then the podcast very suddenly came to a stop in the fall of 2020. If you haven't yet gone back and listened to episode 74, you can do that. That will refresh your memory on the reason why the podcast shut down over 2 years ago. And I want to apologize for that. But more importantly, I want to apologize to the guests that should have been our final episode of what we would call season one. Episode 77, which is what you're about to listen to, was a conversation that I had with Jamie Kaczmarek, who at the time was the head coach at Cardinal Stritch High School near Toledo, and now is the head coach at St. Francis High School in Toledo. I owe Jamie a podcast, and what you're going to listen to is a bit outdated, but I think it's a really good way to wrap up what would have been season one, with the promise that I'll be launching season two in the next few weeks here during the summer of 2023. And one of the things that we will do in season two is get back to catching up with Jamie Kaczmarek and let him tell you more of his story. And talk some hoops with Jamie. But there will be other things between now and then. Like I said, the podcast is going to relaunch, and we're going to call it season two here in the next few weeks in the summer of 2023. And I'm really looking forward to it. I try to get it going the way that it was again in 2020. I don't know that we'll be doing two and three or four podcasts a week like we did for much of 2020 during the pandemic. I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense, but I just want to say that we've had a lot of response from people, particularly in the last few months, even with it being a couple of years since we did anything, to say, we'd love to have the podcast back. When are you going to get it started back up? I love listening and would like to hear more. And those kinds of encouragement have been really great. I have a twin brother who lives in Florida who's been telling me for 2 years, I need to get back to the podcast. And he's got the things that he believes that it's valuable for and the reasons why he wants me to do it. And I appreciate those, and I want to do it. I want to get the podcast going again, really for the people that enjoy listening, to be a part of the basketball community, and to find a way to continue to be attached to the game, but also give back to the game. I've made it very clear throughout the time that we've done the podcast that I love the game. I'm a junkie, and the people and the relationships that I've gotten from the game are really, really important to me. Again, you can listen to episode 74 to have a reminder as to exactly why the podcast shut down. And when we get ready to start season two, there will be one solo episode with just me kind of setting the stage for why it's been 2+ years since the podcast ran and why we're ready to start it back up. And then I look forward to hopefully having some really good guests on again. I don't know how we'll duplicate what was done in season one, but we're going to give it a shot. And I just encourage you, if you haven't yet found your way to this podcast for much of it, go back and everything's archived. You can listen to episodes 1 through 77 now after we get this one published. And I hope that you enjoy it. I hope that it's a good way to get things primed for what I'm hoping is a really productive summer. And like I said, as much as anything else, I owe Jamie Kaczmarek an episode of the podcast that was recorded right before we had to shut things down. And it wasn't ever published until now. And there are reasons for that. And I'll be sharing those at a later date. But I really encourage you to give this a listen and then understand that in the next couple of weeks or month, maybe we're going to get back into another episode with Jamie, get caught up, and then start using that as a springboard towards some episodes with some other great guests. So if you're a regular listener to Talking Hoops with Coach John Cook, welcome back. If you've never been a part of the pod before, please go back and check out some of the archived episodes and hope that you'll stay with us as we go forward.
Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and thanks for joining me for this episode of the Talking Hoops podcast. My guest today is Jamie Kaczmarek, Jamie is the head boys basketball coach at Cardinal Stritch Catholic High School near Toledo, Ohio. He's completed six seasons there, getting ready to begin his seventh season as we record this episode. And he's got a remarkable journey. He's one of the few high school coaches that we will talk to that can talk about experiences at five different Division I universities as an assistant coach. And I think he's got a fascinating story. I hope you enjoy my conversation today with Jamie Kaczmarek of Cardinal Stritch High School. Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and thanks for joining me for this episode of the Talkin' Hoops podcast. My guest today, I talk about everybody's journey being unique and everybody's story is a little different. I'm not sure that I have had a guest on or can have a guest on that can talk about the range of experiences over a coaching career that my guest today can. My guest is Jamie Kaczmarek, the head boys basketball coach at Cardinal Stritch Catholic High School near Toledo, getting ready to start his seventh season and really getting ready. Coach, it's right on top of us here. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you having me on, John. And, well, the time and the effort that you're putting in with these podcasts, they're great, and they're great not only for veteran coaches but for young coaches to listen to, and I think it's awesome that you're doing it.
Well, I appreciate it. I have found my silver lining to COVID-19 is that nobody was too busy to do a podcast. Everybody said yes. It's been outstanding. The guests have all been willing to join in, and you and I have been. We actually scheduled this a couple of weeks back, trying to work out the right time. But I really do want to kind of dive into your story. I think a lot of our listeners are going to be familiar with your name and a little bit familiar with your background. But you're a Northwest Ohio native, so let's just start by talking a little bit about where you grew up, where you went to high school, and then what really officially started your coaching journey.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Rossford, Ohio. I played for Coach Mike Heck at Rossford. You know, grew up in Rossford. Rossford was a big basketball town, had some great teams in the 60s and 70s that made it to state. And growing up, seeing Coach Joe Stalma coach, and then Coach Heck took over for him. You know, you kind of grew up a Rossford Bulldog. You kind of grew up with basketball in your blood. So played at Rossford, and then I went to Bowling Green State University. And when I was in high school, I became, well, actually in sixth grade, Coach Larinaga had taken over the job at BGSU, and we were playing in a CYO championship game down at Westminster in Toledo, which some people from around here, when you say the name Westminster, they'll laugh, because if you played any CYO basketball in Toledo, you played a game in Westminster. And we played against St. Aloysius of Bowling Green, which Jay Larinaga was on the team. And After the game, me and another good friend of mine, Ryan Gladio, Coach Larinaga, came up to us and asked us if we'd like to come to Bowling Green's camp that summer. And so we did. We went to Bowling Green's camp, and Coach Larinaga kind of seeked us out, and we became close friends with Jay going even into junior high. So had a close relationship with the Larinagas growing up through junior high and high school. Jay played at Bowling Green Junior High, and we played Rossford, so we played against each other back when Rossford was in the NLL. And then high school, of course, Jay Larinaga went to St. John's, and we played at Rossford, but we continued to be friends throughout that. So when I went to Bowling Green, Coach Larinaga had asked if I would be interested in helping out the team. So I did. I was an undergraduate assistant / manager, and had that experience with him, and had a great experience. And, you know, it was kind of neat to be in the same class as Antonio Daniels, who ended up being the number four pick overall. And we had a very successful team with Jay Larinaga and some names that people will recognize. Shane Colmise was on that team. Antonio, of course. Anthony Stacy was a very good young player at that time. And DeMar Moore, who is coached in Fremont and now back at Sandusky. So just a really, really good team to be around and be around that program. And so when I graduated from Bowling Green in 1997, that was when Jim O'Brien had just gotten the job at Ohio State. And so Coach Larinaga, I was talking to him, and I was doing anything I could, right, to try to get in that college game. I wanted to try coaching in college. And so I was going around with Clark Francis, who ran, who wrote Hoop Scoop, which was a big recruiting publication back then. And then there was also a magazine called Ohio Roundball Prep that I went with those guys, and we went around to, at that time, the big tournaments, which is when ABCD camp and Nike camp was going on. So went to ABCD camp, and when I was there helping these guys evaluate kids and do write-ups with them, you know, I was a young guy myself, just kind of, you know, went behind the ears just listening to what everybody was saying and doing. Coach Larnega called me over. He was there recruiting, and introduced me to Coach O'Brien. And said, you know, Coach O'Brien just got the job at Ohio State. Want to introduce you to him. You know, that way maybe something down the future or something can happen, but you get to know him. So walked over there, introduced myself, and Coach O'Brien actually at ABCD camp said, you know, I'll call you when I get back off the road in August. Well, as a young guy, you're thinking, oh, that's the punchline, right? That, nice meeting you, but, you know, it never even dawned on me, right? So so continued to do some things that summer with the whole recruiting, you know, and I was sending out letters like crazy, trying to get GA spots. I'm telling you, every day I was sending out mail to anyone and anyone who would listen. And in August, early August, the phone rings. Now, of course, this was before cell phones, right? So the phone rings at the house, and a guy, I say hello, and the guy says, "Is this Jamie Keshmirk there?" And I said, "This is." And he says, "This is Jim O'Brien." So now the thought has gone through my head of what friend from Rossford, Ohio, was pulling one of the worst tricks ever, right? Because I've told people about it, but, you know, not thinking. And so I thought I'd be smart, and, you know, I'd say, and so he asked if I could come down on Friday. I think it was like a Monday or Tuesday when he called, if I could come down on Friday. And so I said, sure. So, but to make sure that it wasn't someone phoning around, I asked for the address to St. John Arena, like, because I'm thinking, right, a friend of mine won't know the exact address.
Right.
Well, of course. You know, he tells me the address, Woody Hayes Drive. So I'm like, oh, this might be it, right? So ended up going down there on that Friday and met with him and met with the coaching staff, which at that time was Rick Boyages was the associate head coach. Paul Biancardi was an assistant coach. Dave Spiller was an assistant coach. And Randy Strout was the director of basketball operations. So met with them. And then, you know, they end up having a meeting. I was out in the hallway with Debbie Cascio, who many high school coaches in Ohio would know from all her years of working as the secretary at Ohio State. And then the door opened, and they brought me in, and they offered me a spot. They said, I don't know what it's going to be, but we would like you to become part of the staff. You come with high recommendations from Coach Larnega. And, you know, so, of course, I'm like, you know, absolutely. And they're like, all right, so can you come and start Monday? Well, I lived in Rossford, right? So I'm like, sure. So my sister had happened. She graduated from Ohio State. She was living in a condo with a friend of hers that was also from Rossford. You know, both Ohio State grads, young, just starting the whole, you know, get their feet in the workforce, all that. And I asked them both, like, do you mind if I move in? So I threw a single bed mattress on the floor of my sister's bedroom in a condo and basically started work that Monday. So it was kind of a crazy experience, probably not one that's normal. And then when I got down there, they still didn't know what my title was going to be or what I was going to do, if I was going to have to take some grad classes or what. And then over a month or so, it got sorted out, and I became the video coordinator, the men's basketball video coordinator. And at that time, I was one of, I might have been like maybe the only video coordinator with that title in NCAA Division I. And then they start popping up like crazy. Maybe I was one of two or three, but it was kind of a neat thing. It was a great opportunity because they had just gotten, it was called the Avid system, which broke down film. You know, at that time, like no other, Avid was actually what they used to make like movies. And now that they were getting into sports. So Ohio State was one of the schools that could afford this big, you know, there was this huge tower. And again, back then you were VHS, you know, it wasn't even DVDs, it was VHS. So got trained on that. And then that following summer, after my 1 year with Ohio State, that following summer, Avid actually hired me out. And I flew around to different Division I universities talking about how we use it at Ohio State and kind of went with a salesperson and did some demos for them. And it was neat because I went to places like Kansas State and Kansas and Iowa. I was around. And it was neat to go around to these different universities and meet coaching staffs and, you know, and explain what we were doing at Ohio State.
Well, you know, Jamie, you said so many things there that just really struck a chord with me. One is you talk about being an undergraduate assistant or slash manager, and I don't know why I am, but I am surprised at the number of guys and ladies that I've had on the podcast that was their start. And that was my start in coaching, was as a student assistant with a Division III program. But if you would just speak briefly to what it is about that role that is more preparation for coaching maybe than the average person might realize?
Well, you know, the managers are, first of all, and I'm not tooting that this was me, but I was just having this conversation the other day. One of my assistant coaches here at Cardinal Scritch, Brad Smith, he's the owner of Marsh's Buckeyes, which is, they make the candy Buckeyes that are excellent, right? And he owns his own company. His mom started it. But he was a manager at Ohio State. I actually hired him, and then I left, which is kind of funny, ironic. But he grew up in Perrysburg. But I was just having this conversation with him because the biggest thing with managers is you don't usually get a lot of money, right? Sometimes by your senior year, they can give you a little bit of scholarship money or something, or they pay for your books maybe. But they'll give you some gear. They'll give you some tennis shoes. But you're working your tail off because of the love of the game. And those guys are the guys who work extremely hard, and they listen and they take it all in, because they're, when you have a passion about the sport to do that, you're ready to learn. And those guys become some of the best coaches because they have learned, they've spent times. I mean, my time as a student assistant, going on the road and, helping assistant coaches, I would drive to games when they were going to recruit, you know, drive them there and drive them back just so they could rest or they could be, you know, doing stuff. Back then, you know, again, when I was in college, cell phones weren't around. Maybe we had it in the bag, but you had the lighter, you know, the plug it in the lighter, you had the bag phone.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, Stan Heath was a assistant coach at Bowling Green when I was there, and riding with Stan Heath up to a game in Michigan, you know, watching the game with him. But then the next day, you know, we had practice early in the morning, so I drove his car back while he got some shut eye in. You know, so when you're willing to do that, type stuff, it's like a work ethic, and those kids that want to be managers or are managers, they do it because they love the passion of the game, they love the game, and they just become, you know, guys that end up just becoming great assistant coaches or even head coaches because they've learned so much. And trust me, over my time at Ohio State, William & Mary, Coastal Carolina, Appalachia State, UNC Wilmington, I've had some of the best managers, and a lot of guys are coaching right now, a lot of them. And Dave Egelhoff is the director of basketball operations at Ohio State. Dave was a freshman manager when I was at Ohio State, and just one of the greatest workers, hardest workers, and he's been with that Ohio State basketball program ever since. And, you know, it's guys like that or experiences like that that really I just tip my hat to those guys that are managers, because people don't understand, you know, how much work and time and hours kids put in. I mean, you know, you got managers that want to splice film and watch film, and there's guys that'll help send out recruiting letters, and now with social media, keeping, you know, social media pages up to date and all that type of stuff. I mean, managers work hours upon hours and don't make anything for it, and it's more because of the love of the game, and then they make some great connections and they become really good coaches.
Well, and you said two things right there. The connections is one piece, but I've always felt about student assistants is that they have to love what they do, because if they didn't, they could decide that some of that stuff is beneath them. You know, what if you're the guy sitting in the corner with the clipboard recording the times on the 40s or the 400s or the agility drills and those kind of things can seem tedious if you're rebounding for a guy after practice or if you're running the shot clock during a practice. Now, at the Division I level, there's more opportunity to look at practice film and splice things and do things that maybe don't happen at the lower levels. But I just think those guys embrace the grind part of it because they see everything as an opportunity. And then what you said about learning the work ethic, that's what translates to the coaching profession. When I was coming out of school at Northern, I can remember Coach Doherty telling me, I interviewed for a head coaching job right after I graduated, and he always said it was a bad idea to be a head coach right out of college. And I asked him about what he said. He said, "John, when I said that to players." He said, players don't understand the grind of coaching. They don't understand the tedious work and the hours that it takes to really be good at it. But he said, you've had the opportunity to see that and be a part of it, and you're probably a little more ready. Now, that's not to say at 23 years old I knew anything. I might not have known shit from apple butter, but I knew how to work, and I understood the grind part of it. And then when you couple that with the fact that every connection is important, then you get some doors open up like you talk about. So you spend some time after your time at BG, and we could do half a podcast on. I'd want to get your best Jim Larrañaga story. Maybe we'll save that for a little bit later. But when you go from a place like BG to a place like Ohio State, you almost kind of have to feel like you landed in Disney World.
You know, that's kind of funny because you know, when I got to Ohio State, that was Coach O'Brien's first year, and we really struggled that year. I think we won 7 games, maybe 8-22, I think is what I recall we were. And it was a grind, right? We won a couple non-league games early, and then, you know, you had Scooney Penn sitting out, and he was taking 4 walk-ons at practice and absolutely murdering our starters. And I mean, it was bad. The one thing that was so neat about Scooney was those walk-ons believed every day that they were better than those other guys, right? Skill-wise, they weren't, but together as a team with Scooney, they believed it, and they would come in, and they would just absolutely dominate, you know, and it was that leadership and that, you know, watching Scooney. So when you're sitting there that year, we were 8-22, you knew there was something special brewing. Now, Michael Redd was a freshman on that team, and he was one of the nation's top scorers. He was averaging over 20 a game, and you saw his skill set, right? And it was like, all right. And then Kenny Johnson was a sophomore who could block shots but really didn't know how to play yet. So, like, you could see some pieces were there, you know, and then with Scooney's leadership, when that thing started to come the following year, you know, it wasn't a shock that we went to the Final Four. So not only were you saying my first job is at Ohio State fresh out of college, we went to the Final Four in year 2 of my coaching career. I mean, I was ready to retire. You know, I mean, it's, you know, but it was an amazing run, but you know, there's a whole other story to the NCAA tournament and all that, but what Scooney Penn meant for that program to change was unbelievable. And it was something that to this day I refer to Scooney a lot because that leadership that I saw that year he sat out. And you never know how kids are going to take sitting out. I mean, even high school transfers or a kid that gets injured, you know, are they going to take the opportunity to become better or are they just kind of going to wait their time to see what happens, right? And Scooney made it every day to be as good as he could be. And that's what, you know, kind of turned that whole Ohio State program around was once he became eligible, it became Scooney's team. Even though we had a star in Michael Redd who, you know, ended up having a great NBA career. And, you know, Scooney never played a second in the NBA, but he had a great professional career overseas and in Greece and made a lot of money and all that. But, you know, when you put those two together, and then the core we had with, you know, Kenny Johnson, who was athletic shot blocker inside, and then you had guys like Jason Singleton, who just played extremely hard, and then George Reese came in as a junior college transfer and provided a big spark, and then Brian Brown was a very good freshman that came in, and then the team just kind of came together, and, you know, they made a run that was a magical one that year to get to the Final Four.
Well, I don't think I'm going to say anything that's going to be like revolutionary and really like, you know, make me sound insightful, but I thought OB was really good at bringing in recruits that might have been just a notch below what you think you need to compete in the Big Ten. Not the big name, you know, five star type guys, but good players that were a little bit undervalued. And I thought for virtually his entire time in Columbus, I thought those guys kind of bought into what it was they were asked to do as individuals. And I always felt like his teams were better than the sum of their parts.
Yeah, you know, the big thing with Coach O'Brien that was very fortunate, especially in my early years, was just how much player development they did. And Rick Boyajis, who became a big mentor of mine, who I still work for today. I went with him when he became the head coach of William Mary, but he's the associate commissioner of the Big Ten, and he runs the Big Ten Consortium for the referees, and I help evaluate Big Ten and MAC and Horizon official forum. So he's been a mentor and a close friend for years now. But they were very, very good at teaching and developing players. And a lot of it was, and I mean, they really broke it down, especially with video. You know, a lot of people who were around those years would know that. I mean, Rick Boyajis was a video freak, and that's who I sat, you know, right next to and taught me a lot about the game, a ton about the game. But we used to break down a lot of film with the guys, and we would tape individual workouts. We would Dave Spiller was really good at trying to take the kids at Ohio State and find pros that they could look up to and splice. We used to call them Phil's Productions, and he would splice VCR tapes of guys for them to like just watch, which kept their interest, right, and kept them hungry and thought, you know, because they felt like, hey, that's a guy I need to watch, that might be who, that could be me one day, right? And they kept, and it helped them kept developing. And you know, we did a very good job of that, and that was probably something I was blessed with that early in my coaching career, because player development's been a big thing that I've been about my whole career. And the kids, even today at Colonel Stritch, will tell you, I mean, we work more on player development, individual, guard, post breakdown than we do practicing as a whole, even during the season. You know, I was very fortunate to work for a lot of very good coaches, but one of them was, I worked for Cliff Ellis, who is trying to win his 800 game this year. He's 18 games away. He's at Coastal Carolina still. And, you know, his whole thing was about player development. And he always said this, and it's something that I'll never forget. Everyone can beat their man that's guarding him. It's being able to read the second defender and make the right decision, whether it's to shoot, pass, you know, shot fake and shoot, whatever it is. Everyone can beat the first defender. It's reading the second defender. And with that comes player development, because it's got to become an instinct. And that's kind of been something that I've hung my hat on coaching, and try to make kids understand the game fundamentally and be able to make those type of reads. And that was something I thought, you know, Coach O'Brien did a great job with. And that's how those guys, I think, became better players than what they were coming out of high school. It was just developing that fundamentals. And you know, we talk about this, and, you know, you've got a lot of guys out there that are workout guys, I guess you would say, right? People are paying top dollars for guys to work out their kids. And when you get to college, it is breaking down the fundamentals like you can't believe. And it's funny, because you see these kids and they're going through 100 different cones and they're shooting over boomsticks and all this type of stuff. And I can tell you, in my 16 years of Division I, a lot of it was jump stops, you know what I mean, pounding the dribble, you know, a combination dribble move, or maybe just a crossover between the legs. You know, nothing crazy. It was making it simple, because you don't have time to do a whole lot of that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
You don't have time to, you know, be sitting there working on a super ton of floaters and all this type of stuff. It was being basic. And I thought Coach O'Brien did a good job at really stressing the fundamentals and preaching it and breaking it down in individuals, and that's shown by that run they made.
Well, and you touched on something we could probably venture off and do a lot of time on with the player development piece. When you talk about the amount of time you spend in player development now, and you're talking about, you know, beating that second defender, the guy that beats the helper, and making the right reads. So when you're spending a lot of time in player development, like you're talking about small sided games, like 2-on-2, 3-on-3 stuff, where you're giving your guys, you know, cues that they read in order to make the right decision. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about with player development?
Yeah, that, but a lot of it is just understanding how to read it. So, you know, we will use, you know, like teaching a kid how to make a straight line drive, right? Most kids, if they come over, because they've seen Allen Iverson do it on a highlight film, right? And they come with a crossover, they want to go, you know, almost 10 feet to the left or right, right? After they cross over, because they think that's what you should do. Instead of, if you're going to cross over, your shoulder is going to be lower than their hip, and you got to play a straight line and attack the basket. That's how you beat guys. So for us, we do a lot of that, where you got to come down and, you know, make a move to get your shoulder below that hip, and now there's another defender waiting for him, and now you got to make a read. You know, is that guy coming totally all the way to stop? You know, is he just going to, what do we call, sword fighting at you in sword fight, so you have to take the pull up? You know, does he come all the way up, so you're going to make the pass? It's putting kids in those situations, because that's what we did a lot in my years of coaching at that level. You know, is really, you know, not so much live 2-on-2, more of live against coaches and managers.
Okay.
And I really use our assistant coaches here. I'm fortunate enough to have a really good staff here. That, you know, like I said, I have Brad Smith, who was at Ohio State and was on OB's staff as a student manager, and then a year as a grad student. And then Bob Gorey is an assistant coach who was at Whitmer with Bruce Smith and at Savannah Southview. And Bobby played at Florida Southern, Division II down in Florida back in the 80s. And then Vaughn Graffin, who used to be the head coach of Bowling Green and Port Clinton, is also on my staff. So I got guys who have been around it and understand, and guys who want to teach you to teach the game. And that's what we're trying to do, is just try to teach the fundamentals. And, you know, it's the biggest thing that when I talk to young coaches is, you know, the game can be simple if you teach it, if you teach the fundamentals the right way. And and people look at me like I'm crazy, but I'm like, you know, the whole KISS theory. Coach O'Brien used to say it all the time, KISS, right? Keep it simple, stupid, right?
Yeah,
that's
amen.
What he used to say to himself, you know, like, all right, we're starting to think way too much into this. He would say that in staff meetings, you know, let's KISS this. Keep it simple, stupid, right? And try to limit it to not confuse our players. And that's what we do.
Well, now we're right up against it, and you talked about teaching the fundamentals the right way, so we're going to take a break here shortly, but I can get a brief answer out of you when I ask this question. You're a base teaching fundamentals believer, and how well you teach that is the most important thing in keeping it simple. So I got to ask, because I've had two or three guys on, and the jury's kind of split, are you a permanent pivot foot guy or an inside pivot foot guy?
I am a permanent pivot foot guy.
God love you. I don't talk to enough guys that are believers in it. And again, I am, for some basic reasons. At the high school level, I think it's great, because I think you get to just start teaching one set of moves and really get good at them.
Yep. No, I am, and to be honest, I was in the North Carolina family there for a little bit, working for Buzz Peterson, and he really taught the permanent, you know, left, right, you know, if you're right-handed,
yep,
your left foot's got to be your pivot foot.
Yep.
And really taught all that. And we really break that down. And that's a lot that we break down with our pivoting, is how to rip across, you know, rip back, all keeping the same pivot foot, all that type of stuff. And I think at high school, it helps a kid become more consistent. With it. So
I love it.
In a nutshell, yes, that's the way I am.
I love it. Now I want to come watch you practice. Unfortunately, I'm not going to get into it now while we're recording this, but it's a lot less likely that I could watch your practice now than it would have been a week and a half ago. I can tell you that.
Exactly.
Well, listen, let's take a short break, and I want to get into the kind of the second half of your college journey. You mentioned William and Mary. I want to touch on that. You mentioned Coastal Carolina. I definitely want to touch on that. And then two more stops before you end up back in high school. We'll do all that right after the break. Hey, I wanted to take just a second and tell you how much I appreciate you listening to the Talking Hoops with Coach John Cook podcast. If you're a regular listener and you enjoy the podcast, I'd like you to consider being a partner to the show. We've lost our sponsorship with Anchor. They're still our platform, but the sponsorship agreement has ended after 4 months. And I would really like you to consider being a sponsor and a partner to the show. There's a place at anchor.fm. where you can donate to the podcast on a monthly basis, and it can be as small as a couple of dollars and as large as you would like it to be. And we would like to consider some title sponsorship if we get some donations that are larger in nature. But I really am just hopeful that a handful of listeners who enjoy what we do here would like to see this continue and allow us the opportunity to gain from it and pay off some things too on our end here at the podcast. So if you're a regular listener to the podcast and you enjoy what we do and you have any interest at all in being a sponsor and making a monthly donation to the podcast, please visit anchor.fm and check out the option of making a monthly donation to the podcast. Greatly appreciate your consideration. And as always, whether you're a donor or not, we hope you continue to listen and find enjoyment in Talking Hoops with Coach John Cook. Jamie Catchmerick is my guest on today's episode of the podcast. And Jamie, before the break, we had talked about, I had said, let's get into how your college coaching journey got started. And we covered a little less than half of it in a half an hour. So we're doing pretty good, but there was a lot there. And for those that are familiar, again, they probably know you were at Ohio State. You mentioned that when Rick Boyajis left Jim O'Brien's staff to become a head coach at the College of William and Mary in 2000, you went with him. And you mentioned your work at Coastal Carolina, which is where you were after William and Mary. How do you get connected from O'Brien's staff and those guys? What was your connection to Coach Ellis, and how'd you end up at Coastal Carolina?
Well, it's kind of crazy. So we go to William and Mary, and we're there for going into our third year. And Rick had really worked, and we started really turn the program around. Now William and Mary, a lot of people think it's private, but it's actually a state school, right? And it's one of the top state schools in the country. So academic wise, you know, your ACT's got to be up there, your GPA's got to be up there. So when you used to recruit for William and Mary, it was pretty easy because you could walk into a AAU tournament, right, and know about 15 guys that you could recruit. The problem was you had a full ride scholarship. But Harvard, Penn, and Princeton were recruiting the same guys, and they could get their tuition down below $5,000 a year or so, and you couldn't beat the Ivy League because they knew if they had that degree from Penn or Princeton or Harvard, they knew what kind of money they were going to make. And
right.
But recruiting was so different there, but it was really neat. It was interesting, and you know, the problem was is as a coaching staff, you were the dumbest people. All your players are so much smarter than you. You know, you'd see them like laughing when you would say something in practice and be like, yeah, you know, I'm from Rochester, Ohio. These kids were recruiting, you know, dads are FBI agents. I mean, it was great. It was a great experience. Great people. I still stand in touch with a lot of the former players there. Williamsburg, Virginia was a beautiful place to live, but this is how it kind of happened. Coach O'Brien asked Rick to come back to Ohio State. And Rick was a competitive guy, and, you know, William and Mary, we had things going. We were going in the right direction, but, you know, OB came back to Rick and, you know, their loyalty, and he just decided, I'm going to go back, right? Well, if you rewind about 9 months earlier, I had gotten married to my wife now of 18 years, Corey. So while we're down there in Williamsburg, she gets a job with a Marriott resort there. Well, she's a marketing director, and they're building a new place in Myrtle Beach. So she gets a job offer to go down there to start this whole resort from scratch. And I'm still coaching at William Ray. This is before Rick even made the decision to leave. So we are, okay, well, we just got to make it work, right? It's a heck of an opportunity for her, and we'll figure it out. Well, then Rick ends up leaving. So now, you know, I'm like, all right, well, I need a job. At that time at Coastal Carolina, the head coach was Pete Strickland.
Yeah.
Now, Pete Strickland was assistant at Dayton. And one of my high school teammates, Matt Gladio from Rossford, played for Pete at Coastal Carolina. So when Rick leaves William & Mary, Tony Shaver gets the job. Tony Shaver was a head coach at Randolph-Macon. He played at North Carolina. Really good guy. Got the job. Well, he hires Ted Jeffries. Ted Jeffries was an assistant coach at Coastal Carolina. Ted Jeffries played at Virginia, was a good player at Virginia, all ACC, and he hires Ted from Coastal Carolina. Well, I knew Coach Strickland from Matt Gladio playing there, also from the days at Dayton, so I call him up, know that Ted's getting that job, and he says, yeah, well, Ted's leaving. Well, why don't you come down and interview? So I end up talking to him. He ends up hiring me. So I drive, this is a crazy story. When the whole thing gets settled, I drive William & Mary's courtesy car down to Coastal Carolina's campus. I give the keys to Ted Jeffries, who now drives to his new home in Williamsburg, and he gives me the keys to his courtesy car that's right there at Coastal Carolina. That's where my wife lives, right? That's where my wife's working. So it ends up working out. Great. I was with Coach Strickland for 2 years, and then Pete got let go, and so this is another, I mean, my stories are endless, but here's another crazy one, right? So you got that whole crazy thing when that happened. Coach Strickland gets let go. They asked me to take over the program because they have their eyes set on somebody. And hopefully, I was still young at this time, and, you know, if they get who they want, then, you know, they'll try to talk this coach into possibly keeping me on. But if not, they'll pay me a little bit of extra money. They didn't have me go to the Final Four so I could really stay and make sure the kids didn't just go crazy, right? Because there's a coaching change, don't lose recruits, all that type stuff. So I do that. Well, the person that they went after was Buzz Peterson. Buzz Peterson had just gotten let go from Tennessee. And our women's basketball coach at Coastal Carolina was Alan LaForce.
Yeah, yeah.
So Alan LaForce was the head coach at East Tennessee State when they had Mr. Jennings, and they upset Arizona in the NCAA tournament, and was a very good coach at East Tennessee State. And Buzz had worked with him at East Tennessee State at one time. So he was the connection to Buzz Peterson. Well, Buzz ends up taking a job. And when Buzz comes in, I talk to him, interview with him, and Buzz ends up hiring me. So it did work out as the way Coastal said it. And, you know, it was, and then I worked for Buzz Peterson, and we had two wonderful years together. And then Buzz's college roommate, who most people probably know, by the name of Michael Jordan, he calls Buzz and offers Buzz a job at that time with the Bobcats. You know, they were the Bobcats, and they weren't the Hornets. And so Buzz called me Cash. So he called me in the office. He's like, Cash, I think I got to go with MJ with this. For his Bobcats job. So here I go again, right? Like, my wife and I now have built a house down in Myrtle Beach, you know, and we just had our first child, our son at that time. So I'm like, oh, here we go again. Well, they make me the interim head coach and go through the whole interview process, and it comes down to me and Cliff Ellis, right? Cliff Ellis is the former coach at Auburn. You know, Clemson.
Yeah.
He knows the governor of South Carolina. He knows everybody, right? And here's, you know, this Polish guy from Rossford, Ohio, who's trying to tread water, and we're going to go interview against each other, right? So meet with AD, the president, all that. They call me in, and they say, listen, you know, we're going to give this job to Cliff, but Cliff wants you to stay on as the associate head coach. You know, and at times you're heartbroken, right? Because you think you're going to get it. You go through the whole interview. You know, it was the whole kit and caboodle. Like, the interview involved your wife. It was like a 2-day process, all that type of stuff. So you thought you were in there. But anyways, I get hired by Cliff, and it is an amazing experience. Cliff Ellis is so knowledgeable of the game, right? And it was something that was one of the greatest experiences I have, because it was so old school. So Cliff, like, didn't really use a computer and still doesn't. Everything was on legal pads, okay? He wrote down everything. I'm talking everything, all right? I still have these booklets, 3-ring binders, that he called the offensive Bible and defensive Bible of the year. And he wrote down everything we did, every play, and he kept it, and he made copies for his whole staff. And you have this of plays he saw, plays we did. I mean, he watched so much film and was just a basketball junkie that he taught me so much. So, like, as much as I wanted to be a head coach, those years of being with him were unbelievable. So then I'm there with him for 2 years, and Buzz decides he doesn't like the NBA. And he goes back and takes the head coach at Appalachian State. So Buzz then calls me and says, I want you to be the associate head coach at Appalachian State. And Buzz and I became really close, and still close today. Matter of fact, this summer we spent time at his house and with my family, and our families are really close. So I ended up leaving Cliff after 2 years and going to Appalachian State with Buzz. Then we went up there. We won in 1 year. I lived in the Appalachian Mountains. I thought we'd lived there for a couple of years. We lived there for 8 months, and we got the UNC Wilmington job. So, but going back to Coach Ellis, when we talk about earlier in this podcast, we talked about managers, right? So Cliff Ellis never played basketball. So Cliff went to Chipola Junior College, and then he went to Florida State, but didn't go to Chipola. That's where he grew up. That's what area he was from. So he wasn't a guy who, like, played, but he loved the game. And so he wanted to get into coaching, and he would talk to a bunch of different people. Now, the one thing about Cliff Ellis that no one knows is Cliff Ellis was a professional singer for the Villagers.
Yeah, I've actually heard that story. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so, like, he opened up for the Beatles at one time, all right? So, like, he did, when I was with them, sang a lot of the beach music. You know, I got his CDs. It's funny. I mean, unbelievable voice, you know, great singer. He was also a gourmet cook. All right. I mean, he could cook like no other. So like, he had a bunch of different interests. But the thing about it is, when he was asking about how to get into coaching, a guy told him, well, you know, and Cliff's older. So Cliff, at this time, right, there's no social media, there's no computers, all that stuff. Like, the only way you're going to get someone's attention is if you write a book. So Cliff, right out of college, wrote a book on basketball, wrote a book on drills that he had learned and all this type of stuff. So he wrote a book. A junior college, and it slips my mind which one it was, that hired him first. This job opens, so Cliff goes there, and he takes the book. And the president of the university looks at the AD and says, if this guy wrote a book, how do we not hire him? And they're like, yeah, that's a good point. So he gets hired. And he was a successful junior college coach. Then from there, he got the South Alabama job, and turned South Alabama into a winner. Then he got the Clemson job. He's the only guy in Clemson history to win the ACC the regular season at Clemson. He had a guy by the name of Eldon Campbell, who played with the Lakers.
My favorite Eldon Campbell story was when he was with the Lakers, when they asked him if he earned his degree from Clemson, and he said, no, but they gave me one anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And then he went to Auburn. And the funny thing is the year that we went to the Final Four, you talked about basketball being a small circle. Okay. That year we go to the Final Four, we have to play number one seed Auburn down in Knoxville. After we beat Murray State in the first round, and then Detroit in the second round. Then we had to play Auburn in the first round, who was coached by Cliff Ellis. So not only did I did we beat Auburn, but next thing I know, I was assistant coach for Cliff Ellis, who we played against. But just a great experience for Coach Ellis. Him and I have kept in contact. There's a whole other story with me running the CIT tournament, but, you know, Coastal Carolina has been in it many years, and Coach Ellis has been a great mentor and someone that I enjoy talking to all the time. I mean, the first thing he says when you call him is he always asks about your family, and that's the kind of person he was. He just, he cared about his people, and, it was a great experience coaching for a guy who, like I said, he's 18 wins away from 800. And that's a lot of victories.
There's no question about it. And what I find interesting, Jamie, about your story now is that there are, I guess it's a relative term, but there are a lot of guys in coaching who can relate to the kind of circuitous route you took. I mean, Bowling Green, Ohio State, William & Mary, Coastal Carolina, Appalachian State, UNC Wilmington. That's not a rare type of existence for guys that are really chasing the college game. The question I have for you is, with a resume that includes time under Jim Larranaga, Jim O'Brien, Rick Boyajis, Buzz Peterson, Cliff Ellis, what's the determining factor for you? I mean, is it your family situation? Is it your age? Or what kind of came together for you to make the decision that maybe it's time to do something besides college coaching?
To be honest, it's my kids, my family. I grew up in Rossford, small town, was always around family, right? My, you're always around your cousins, around everything. And, in my journey, I saw a lot of great coaches and been around a lot of great assistants and all that. And I saw a lot of assistants miss their kids' lives. If that's, and I'm not saying guys that I personally worked with, but guys that I got to know in the business, right? Like their kid went from, fifth grade to sophomore in college, and friends I know, like, totally missed it, right? Like, didn't see games, soccer game, didn't see all that type of stuff. And when I had gotten that to that point, so I just put it, this would be the biggest example of how it can be tough on a family. So when I'm at Coastal Carolina, and I don't know if you'll ever remember this or not, there happened to be a wildfire that started in Myrtle Beach, right? Sure. And this year, it was in 2009, and we have our son, my wife's pregnant, and the wildfire starts way out. And everybody is out taking pictures. You can see the smoke for miles, blah, 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 And I lived in a golf course community. It's called Barefoot Landing, if anybody's ever been in North Myrtle Beach. So it's got golf courses. It was a neat community. We had a golf cart. You drove around. So my brother and sister-in-law happened to be in town on this Wednesday night. They flew in, and we're going, and you can see like this pink haze, and we took the golf cart out on the golf course, and you can see it. It was way out miles. Well, about 2 o'clock in the morning that night, my wife wakes me up and says, "What's going on with the TV?" And our TV's going on and off, right? Mm-hmm. So she had it on when we fell asleep, and I go outside, and I'm like, "Man, those wildfires are burning. You can smell it." I go to my front door, and I can see across the street from my house and another house, but behind them, I can see flames that are probably 30 feet in the air. The wildfire had now gone from Conway, which was way out. The wind blew it in. It jumped 6 lanes of expressway, and it got into Barefoot. And our neighborhood was basically on fire. So we get out. And we with my wife working for a resort, that helped, because we ended up going to her resort, right? And the wildfires ended up burning down most of the neighborhood. Lucky for me, my house did not get burned down, but there was like 85 homes burned down in our community. And my wife was pregnant at this time. Well, that was on Wednesday. On Saturday, Buzz got offered the job at Appalachian State and calls me. Right? So our house almost burns down on Wednesday. Saturday, he calls me. Corey and Buzz's wife became really close friends. So she says, yeah, we have to take this job, right? So now I accept the job. Our house is okay, but our neighbors have no houses. I mean, our neighborhood looked like a war zone. Like all those fires you see in California and stuff, it's amazing. I mean, we had it up. I mean, I lived through it, right? So to make a long story short, my daughter, my wife stays there until Labor Day because my daughter is born in June. On June 7th, she was born in Myrtle Beach because all our doctors are there. They move up Labor Day weekend to Appalachian State. In 8 months, we win. We move to UNC Wilmington, all right? So my daughter is not even one yet, and she has now lived in Myrtle Beach, born in Myrtle Beach. Labor Day weekend, she moves to Boone, North Carolina, and on Memorial Day weekend, she moves to Wilmington, North Carolina. So before she's one, she lives in three different places. And then 3 years later, you know, we're in it, and it just became time. You know, the recruiting and being gone, and you know, it was time. It was time. Now, I think I was going to coach high school. I didn't. I really didn't. We moved back here. I lost my father to cancer in 2007. You know, my mom, she's still alive today, 84 years old. It was just, I thought it was time. You know what I mean? It was time to come back. My wife's from here, from Toledo, and I wanted my kids to be around cousins, aunt and uncles, and everything that I grew up with. I just thought it was something that I needed. It needed to be fair to my kids. And, you know, a lot of people are like, how do you give up all that? You know, a lot of people see the college coaching, right, on television. You're on television for 2 hours, right? You're like a superstar, a movie. But there's a lot to it. And you know this from being around in the college game. You know, coaching on the court and coaching the game of basketball in college is probably 15% of what you do. It's the recruiting. It's the, you know, the grind of all that type of stuff. And I just thought it was time for a change and a time to make a commitment to our family. And Rick Boyajis, there was the associate commissioner and still is of the Big Ten. And he said, why don't you come and, you know, help me out. And I was doing some other things and I run the CIT and I had a few opportunities. And then the funny thing is I met Dave Boyce at Perrysburg and started talking to him, and he asked if I would like work out a few of his kids. He would like to see how we did things in college and blah, blah, blah. So I started doing that, and then I started doing it more and more and more. And then Dave said to me, well, would you volunteer? And I'm like, yeah, I'm only going to volunteer because I don't know if I'm going to be here that much. You know, I don't know how much I do. And he said, hey, no problem. Anything you can do will be fine. Well, of course I was in the gym all the time. Then really enjoyed my year at Perrysburg, and then Colonel Stritch called and said they got my name from somebody and would I be interested in talking, and the rest is history. And I became a high school coach and now associate athletic director, along with working for the Big Ten Consortium and running the CIT.
I guess on the heels of what you just described, a couple things. Number one, when you leave the Division I college game and you spent all that time with Buzz Peterson, it's been my experience, and at least the guys I've gotten to be around, and a lot of the people I know in coaching are fairly well connected to guys at the Division I level. I am not, but a lot of the people I know are. And I hear a lot about, particularly at that level, guys are just – there's so much pressure to win. There's so much pressure to – produce that they're almost maniacal about making sure they're surrounded with people they know and they can trust. I'm going to ask this without any real knowledge of it, but when you talk about the grind of recruiting and making the decision that it's time to go, I'm going to get out of this, I'm going to guess, Jamie, and tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, leaving the guy who leans on you might be the toughest part of that transition.
Yes, most definitely. But, you know, the thing I was, and I'm going to say this, I mean, I was blessed with all the guys I worked for, is they were all great guys and great family guys. And Buzz Buzz is like over the top when it comes to the family part. And like I said, we were just down there in August with his family at his house. You know, Buzz is like a uncle to my kids, you know. Their children call my kids all the time. We've all gotten older. Buzz's son, who, you know, was a little pain in the butt at camp all those years, now is going into his junior year playing with Tubby Smith at High Point and is one of the leaders on the High Point team. So it's been neat, but, you know, it's a family. We still are a family. You know, we text quite a bit all the time. You know, and it, you know, he's now the assistant GM at the Hornets, and, you know, would something come up somewhere down the road to go back with him? Maybe, but, you know, I don't know. I my biggest thing is the family part, you know, and my kids like being back home, and I'm fortunate to still have my, you know, my mom's still alive at 84, and, you know, it's been great for them to be here. My wife's parents are both here. My father-in-law actually was my JV coach here, Cardinal Stritch, for five of my first 6 years. So that was fun, you know, to have the family be part of this, the success we've had here at Stritch. So, you know, it was very difficult, but yet, you know, it's a business, and you know what, it, you know, I mean, everybody knows it. And as I say, people ask this all the time, everyone's replaceable. You know, yeah. as much as you think you may be really good, everyone's replaceable. You can be replaced, and the kids that you're coaching and all that, they're resilient. You know, and the next day, if there's a new coach, then they're gonna adapt to who the new coach is. And you know, that's something that I try to say to everyone. Don't, hey, you know, everyone's replaceable. So you know, if you think you work hard and all that, which is great, you know, there's other people that work just as hard, if not harder, you know, and that's the big thing. And that's what I think you learn from that business, especially at that Division I level, you know, and that's where guys get burnt out, because when you are recruiting, right, and you're sitting at home and it's 10:30 at night, you're like, all right, who can I text in the West Coast that we're recruiting? Because I got to make sure that I touch base with somebody, because someone's doing it. And if I'm sitting here having a good time, then, you know, someone's getting up on us. You know what I mean?
Right, and, sure,
And that's that thought process the whole time. And that's where that grind, you know, it could drive you a little batty, you know?
I would certainly think so. I don't have a hard time understanding that at all. I mean, the reasons to get out are there's plenty of them, and it's a lot of times it's hard to make the decision. You made the decision and probably maybe felt like you were going to be out of coaching. I'm curious, because you spent so much time with such high level quality coaches at the college level. When you spent a year working with Coach Boyce at Perrysburg, I love to kind of, if you could just kind of identify what were a couple of things maybe that you learned in your time with Coach Boyce. I mean, you learned a lot from a lot of great coaches, but the game is so unique in how it can be coached and how it can be taught and how different coaches can approach it. Can you put your finger on maybe one or two things that you gained from your experience with Coach Boyce?
Well, I gained a lot of frowns by the old faithful Bulldogs of Rossford, because growing up in the NLL, that was the big rival playing Perrysburg. But no, I mean, Dave was great. It was great to be part of his staff. Yeah, to be honest, his matchup zone, the zone that he likes to run, was a kind of a neat thing to see his version of it. Because all my years of scouting opponents and all that, you've seen about every zone possible and how the rotations are made. I also think Dave was a very good game coach. Dave runs a lot of sets and has his sets, but knows when to call them. I thought he was very good in games of how a defense is either, you know, going to overplay you, or a team might have made a run, and now, you know, he hits you with a backdoor play when that defense, you know, is feeling good about themselves and they're really up on their toes and really trying to pressure you, and then all of a sudden he would break their back with a good backdoor play, or, you know, the guy who's hot and how to get them off. And set them the right screens and all that. I just thought I thought Dave was very, very good at making those adjustments in the game. And but the zone was neat. The rotations were neat. The way he broke it down in practice and broke down, let's just say, the top line of the zone and the bottom line of the zone at different ends and how he thought the rotations of it. I thought that was kind of a neat thing to see. I mean, no matter how old you are, how many years you've coached, you can see basketball is an open book and you can learn every day. And I think I've been fortunate, heck, I've gone against some really good coaches, people talk about college coaches and, professional coaches and all that. Hey, coaches can coach. And some of your best coaches are high school coaches. Some of your best coaches could even be junior high coaches. If guys know how to coach and know what they're doing and success, you don't have to be, coaching at UCLA or Duke. You can be coaching at your local high school and be just as good a coach as what I've seen and gone against. And I've been fortunate, right? I've coached in games in Madison Square Garden and at North Carolina, and I've been all those places. But I've also been in gyms of Toledo Christian and different places where, and being around Coach Boyce and just seeing guys that can really coach. And, no matter what, you're on a basketball court, the rims are 10 foot high, and, guys that can coach can really teach the game no matter what level it's at.
Well, and you got to experience so much. And I think I've said this probably on three or four different podcasts that we've recorded. I know John Beilein is fond of the expression that when you're coaching basketball, you can do anything you want, but you can't do everything you want. So when you've got such a wide range of experiences and so many different philosophies and styles of play and the guys that you worked for, and then you get your own high school program, how do you go about paring things down, making decisions, and building what your offensive and defensive philosophies are out of all of that stuff? What's your process like in creating what you want your program to be?
Well, so it's a little, I guess my approach is different than what I would say most coaches would be because of my experience. So when I decided to become the head coach at high school, my total focus was to try to provide kids opportunities to play at the next level. That was my whole goal with this is, all right, so from my past 16 years, right, what before coming into high school, my 16 years of coaching at college, what can I do to try to help kids be able to play at that level? Because I know what the game of basketball offers and that the experience of playing at the next level, whether it's Division III, junior college, Division II, Division I, NAIA, that the game of basketball can open up the whole world to a lot of different people. And I've been blessed. I've been around this world, because of this game. And that's what I wanted to provide. So my thought process going into it was I have to develop the kids the way we did in college of what I was talking about, breaking down the fundamentals, trying to make them the best. Understanding how important the weight room is and changing your body and how you approach things so that you are ready for that next level. The kids that make it, and now you're not going to have a team full of college basketball players. I understood that, but I wanted to coach it that way. Because if you coach that way and you start having that success and you do start developing players that can play at that level, success is going to come because of kids believing in themselves. And when kids start getting self-confidence, that's what makes them really good basketball players. And those are the ones the kids that once they get confidence, and that's why the weight room, I think, is very important. I mean, today I was laughing watching we had a big weight room session today, and it's always my little guards, right? They want to take their shirts off and look in the mirror now because they got, their little muscles are sticking out. So but that confidence also brings confidence on the court because they feel they're stronger, they're quicker, they're faster. You know what I mean? And it's all one big thing to believe in themselves. And so that was kind of how my approach was with with the game, because I think that's a little bit of what the college game is. You know what I mean? It's not so much your X's and O's. When you watch a college program, it's how important the conditioning is and the weightlifting. I mean, you know, if you think about the game of basketball at the college level, the weight room is 3 to 4 days a week, especially in the off season. During the season, it's at least 2 or 3 days a week. You got individual skill or four-man groups out of season, and you also go into in-season. So when it's that important all the time, that's what makes college basketball programs successful, right? But then you bring it in together as a whole. But the whole, I think, becomes greater with the little pieces that you do of the weightlifting and the individual instruction. And that's kind of what we do here at Cardinal Stretch. I mean, that's a big piece. And it was something that I kind of brought and was able to share a little bit with Coach Boyce at Perrysburg was, you know, here's what you got to do. You know, this is what you do. You try to make these kids better, because then they're confident and then they're going to listen because they want to achieve. They want to, you know, you got to make them hungry. So they can see, you know, a little bit of that. And I've been lucky. I have coached. When I came here to Stretch, we had a young man who was a really good player, had a great career at Tiffin University, Austin Adams. And we were blessed my first year that we made a run to the regionals and basically rode his back. But when I came here, Austin never lifted weights. You know, he was one of those guys that was told that lifting weights would screw up your shot. And I'm like, Austin, first of all, you know, but we got to work on your shot, so the weights ain't going to screw it up. We got to change it a little bit. And, you know, he ended up having a heck of a career here at Cardinal Stretch, was the leading scorer until Joey Ellifield took that over last year. And then, you know, so we've had him. We, you know, I had a young man at play that sat in a corner and he shot threes. Colin Yost playing at Mount St. Joseph. And then that year we went to the state. There's four kids. Little Anderson was a starter last year as a freshman at Lourdes. Jordan Burton, who was our point guard, was a starting point guard last year at Notre Dame College in Cleveland. Nolan Finch is down at Bluffton University, played JV last year, but I believe he'll make varsity this year for Bluffton. And Ashton Carrier, redshirted last year at Tiffin, so he's a redshirt freshman for Tiffin this year. And then you got Joey Ellifield, went to Oakland, will be a freshman at Oakland this year. And then Devin Jones, who last year only played a game and a half when he broke his wrist. They're telling me is at Concordia in Ann Arbor, and they're telling me they think he's going to be a starter, which really would have helped last year if he would have played more than a game and a half. But, you know, it is what it is. But so what I'm getting at is, you know, that's what I wanted to bring when I got to high school, was to give kids opportunities. And we've been fortunate enough to have kids. And, you know, I got a point guard, Jaden Wilson, this year, who has Division II offers, and I have a big kid, Ross Thompson, who's got NAIA offers. So hopefully we can keep this ball rolling and keep having kids get opportunities, because that was my ultimate goal getting into high school. And if I can develop kids to be good enough to play at that level, the wins at the high school level will come, because you'll have good enough players. So as simple as that seems, it's really our concept. To develop kids to be as good as they possibly can be and have them hungry to get to that level.
So let me ask you this, and this may be the final question. I wanted to try to respect your time and try to keep things to an hour. We're a little bit over that now. But if I went to an Austin Adam or Colin Yost, Ashton Carrier, Joey Ellifield, the guys you mentioned that are playing at the next level, if I got those guys collectively in front of me and I asked them individually, they had to answer me, what is Cardinal Stretch basketball? If I said, what's 32 minutes of Cardinal Stretch basketball done the right way? What's it look like? What kind of answer am I going to get from you, from the guys that play for you?
You know, the thing that I hear all of them say, and I think this is kind of the point I was getting at, is that they all were prepared for that. So when they got to college, right, and practice started or conditioning started, to them, it was what we're doing. You know what I mean? It, right. it was it, wasn't something new to them. They were prepared for that. And that's my goal. My goal is to try to make that transition as easy as possible. And the reason being is I've been on the other end of it so much where, you know, a kid comes in to a program like at UNC Wilmington or Coastal Carolina, right? I mean, South Carolina had athletes everywhere, right? You would go to one high school game and, you know, 9 out of 10 players on the court could touch the rim with their forehead, right? Like, I mean, they were athletic, but none of them knew how to play. So you would take some of these kids and they sat in a 2-3 zone their entire life, right? They don't know how to play man-to-man. They don't understand, you know, ball side, weak side, help side. They don't know any of this terminology. And as a coach and as a college coach, it was frustrating, but it was also frustrating because it seemed unfair to the kid because the kid was lost, and sometimes it cost him an opportunity of maintaining the scholarship or making him have to transfer because he was so behind because he just wasn't prepared the right way. Because no matter what, in college, right, it's a business, and it's wins and losses, and you don't have total time to, if kids, you know what I mean, if they're way behind, right, it is what it is, it's a business. So that was my whole take when I decided to start working with young people, especially at the high school level, is to prepare them for that, because I also think the ones who don't go on to play college, the way we work and the way we nitpick the fundamentals and our approach to everything is what real life is going to be. So you're going to be disciplined when you go to college and try to teach discipline so that way they're focused on getting their academics right. And when they go to college, they're motivated to try to be the best they can be. You know, my first year at Stritch, I mean, I got three guys that are engineers. I got one that was, accountant, you know. So I'm hoping that the discipline we had in our program, the work ethic, helped them maintain that when they went into college to be a student or whatever their career is that they attacked. And I think that's the key with what we're trying to do here is prepare these young men, the ones that are fortunate enough to have the ability to go play, to be able to go play and make that transition into college, the ones who don't, take what we've built them with fundamentals and the skills to try to go and be the best they can be at whatever it is their future holds, whether it's just being a great husband, a great father, you know, a great worker, whatever it is, that's what our goal is here at Stritch, is just to try to prepare these guys. And it's because of all the great people that I've been around and been fortunate to coach with, I've seen them be able to do that, because not everyone makes it to the NBA from college, and not everyone makes it to Europe to go play, you know, and you gotta, there's a lot of kids that, you know, I say, if you have an opportunity to use basketball to get free education, to make connections, and to make a great career, then you gotta bust your butt to do it, because it's a great game, and it's something that you have to take advantage of. And I think that's what all the guys would say if you sat down and talked to them, is that they were prepared for that first year of college. It wasn't overwhelming to them. And I think that's what our goal is as a staff. And, you know, and we've been blessed to have kids to be able to do it.
Well, by the time this podcast gets published, you will be just getting about ankle deep into year number 7. And you'll be starting that journey and that process over with another group of young men. I want to wish you the best of luck. I'm thinking here as an associate athletic director, you'll still be dealing with COVID protocols and all the restrictions that you're probably going to have to help your school manage. But we're hoping we can get that somewhat behind us and praying that we get to have a full season. You get to spend the time with your guys that you want to spend. I want to wish you the best of luck and just really, really appreciate you taking time to come on and be a part of the podcast.
I appreciate it, John. It's great. And again, it's great that you're doing this. And I hope all the coaches out there are enjoying it as much as I am.
Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. Now, you know, if you've listened to any of them, that I've become a guy who asks just blatantly, just no shame whatsoever. I want a Cardinal Stritch basketball shirt. And if I got to come watch a practice to get one, I've got a nice little collection of shirts now, and I'm I'm kind of going to figure out what I think I'm going to make a t-shirt quilt out of all the shirts from the podcast episode. But I will, you and I spoke before we started recording. There's various reasons that might prevent me from getting to a practice, but at some point before this season is over, you will see me at a Cardinal Stritch event somewhere, whether it's tournament time or what it is. I hope things go well for you guys, and you and I will catch up down the road. I promise.
I appreciate that, John. A shirt is on your way.
You met, man. Thanks, Jamie. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, John.
Thanks so much for listening again today. If you would like to listen to previous or future episodes of the Talking Hoops with Coach John Cook podcast, you can listen on Spotify or Google Podcasts, as well as several other podcast platforms. Please review, rate, and subscribe. And if you would like to support the podcast financially, you can do so at anchor.fm/John-Cook. That's JONCOOK0. anchor.fm/John-Cook0. Thanks again. Hope to talk hoops with you again real soon.